touch we've ever shared. His scent is all around me. His heat, his exhalations, gold eyelashes and green eyes. I touch his face, almost without meaning to, gently, like he might be a ghost. Like this might be a dream, and the tips of my fingers graze his cheek, trail the line of his jaw, and I stop when his breath catches, when his body shakes almost imperceptibly, and we lean in as if by memory, eyes closing, lips just touching.
"Give me another chance,"
he whispers, resting his forehead against mine. My heart aches, throbs in my chest.
"Please,"
he says softly, and he's somehow closer now, his lips touching mine as he speaks, and I feel pinned in place by emotion, unable to move as he presses the words against my mouth, his hands soft and hesitant around my face, and he says,
"I swear on my life,"
he says,
"I won't disappoint you."
And he kisses me, right here in the middle of everything, in front of everyone, and I'm flooded, overrun with feeling, my head spinning as he presses me against the hard line of his body, and I can't save myself from myself. I can't stop the sound I make when he parts my lips and I'm lost, lost in the taste of him, lost in his heat, wrapped up in his arms, and I have to tear myself away. Pulling back so quickly, I nearly stumble. I'm breathing too hard, my face flushed, my feelings panicked. And he can only look at me, his chest rising and falling with an intensity I feel from here, from 2 feet away, and I can't think of anything right or reasonable to say about what just happened or what I'm feeling, except, "This isn't fair," I whisper. Tears threaten, sting my eyes. "This isn't fair." And I don't wait to hear his response before I tear down the hall, bolting the rest of the way back to my rooms.
Warner. "Trouble in paradise, Mr. Warner." I've got him by the throat in seconds, shocked, disfiguring his expression as I slam his body against the wall. "You," I say angrily. "You forced me into this impossible position. Why?" Castle tries to swallow, but can't, his eyes wide, but unafraid. When he speaks, his words are raspy, suffocated. "You had to do it," he chokes out. "It had to happen. She needed to be warned, and it had to come from you." "I don't believe you," I shout, shoving him harder against the wall. "And I don't know why I ever trusted you. Please, son, put me down." I ease up, only a little, and he takes in several lungfuls of air before saying, "I haven't lied to you, Mr. Warner. She had to hear the truth, and if she'd heard this from anyone else, she'd never forgive you. But at least now," he coughs, "with time, she might. It's your only chance at happiness." "What?" I drop my hand, drop him. "Since when have you cared about my happiness?" He's quiet for too long, massaging his throat as he stares at me. Finally, he says, "You think I don't know what your father did to you? What he put you through?" And now I take a step back. "You think I don't know your story, son? You think I'd let you into my world, offer you sanctuary among my people, if I really thought you were going to hurt us?" I'm breathing hard. Suddenly confused, feeling exposed. "You don't know anything about me," I say, feeling the lie even as I say it. Castle smiles, but there's something wounded in it. "You're just a boy," he says quietly. "You're only 19 years old, Mr. Warner, and I think you forget that all the time. You have no perspective, no idea that you've only barely lived. There's still so much life ahead of you." He sighs. "I tried to tell Kenji the same thing, but he's like you. Stubborn," he says. "So stubborn. I'm nothing like him. Did you know that you're a year younger than him? Age is irrelevant. Nearly all my soldiers are older than me. Castle laughs. All of you kids, he says, shaking his head. You suffer too much. You have these horrible, tragic histories, volatile personalities. I've always wanted to help, he says. I've always wanted to fix that. Make this world a better place for you kids. Well, you can go save the world somewhere else, I say. And feel free to babysit Kishimoto all you like. But I'm not your responsibility. I don't need your pity. Castle only tilts his head at me. You will never escape my pity, Mr. Warner. My jaw clenches. You boys, he says, his eyes distracted for a moment. You remind me so much of my own sons. I pause. You have children? Yes, he says, and I feel his sudden, breathtaking wave of pain wash over me as he says, I did. I take several unconscious steps backward, reeling from the rush of his shared emotions. I can only stare at him, surprised, curious, sorry. Hey. At the sound of Nazira's voice, I spin around, startled. She's with Hader, the two of them looking grave. What is it? I say. We need to talk. She looks at Castle. Your name is Castle, right? He nods. Yeah, I know you're wise to this business, Castle, so I'm going to need you to get in on this too. Nazira whips her finger through the air to draw a circle around the four of us. We all need to talk. Now.
Juliet. It's a strange thing to never know peace. To know that no matter where you go, there is no sanctuary. That the threat of pain is always a whisper away. I'm not safe locked into these four walls. I was never safe leaving my house, and I couldn't even feel safe in the 14 years I lived at home. The asylum kills people every day. The world has already been taught to fear me, and my home is the same place where my father locked me in my room every night, and my mother screamed at me for being the abomination she was forced to raise. She always said it was my face. There was something about my face, she said, that she couldn't stand. Something about my eyes, the way I looked at her, the fact that I even existed. She'd always tell me to stop looking at her. She'd always scream it, like I might attack her. Stop looking at me, she'd scream. You just stop looking at me, she'd scream. She put my hand in the fire once. Just to see if it would burn, she said. Just to check if it was a regular hand, she said. I was 6 years old then. I remember because it was my birthday. An excerpt from Juliet's journals in the asylum. Never mind, is all I say when Kenji shows up at my door. Never mind what? Kenji sticks his foot out to catch the closing door. Now he's squeezing his way in. What's going on? Never mind, I don't want to talk to any of you. Please go away. Or maybe you can all go to hell. I don't actually care. Kenji looks stunned, like I just slapped him in the face. Are you serious right now? Nazira and I are leaving for the symposium in an hour. I have to get ready. What? What's happening, Jay? What's wrong with you? Now I turn to face him. What's wrong with me? Oh, like you don't know. Kenji runs a hand through his hair. I mean, I heard about what happened with Warner, yeah, but I'm pretty sure I just saw you guys making out in the hallway, so I'm, really confused. He lied to me, Kenji. He lied to me this whole time about so many things, and so did Castle, so did you. Wait, what? He grabs my arm as I turn away. Wait, I didn't lie to you about shit. Don't mix me up in this mess. I had nothing to do with any of it. Hell, I still haven't figured out what to say to Castle. I can't believe he kept all this from me. I go suddenly still, my fists closing as my anger builds and breaks, holding fast to sudden hope. "You weren't in on all of this?" I say. "With Castle?"
"Uh-uh. No way. I had no clue about any of this insanity until Warner told me about it yesterday."
I hesitate. Kenji rolls his eyes.
"Well, how am I supposed to trust you?"
I say, my voice rising in pitch like a child.
"Everyone's been lying to me."
"Jay,"
he says, shaking his head.
"Come on. You know me. You know I don't bullshit. That's not my style."
I swallow hard, feeling suddenly small, feeling suddenly broken inside. My eyes sting and I fight back the impulse to cry. "You promise?"
"Hey,"
he says softly.
"Come here, kid."
I take a tentative step forward and he wraps me up in his arms, warm and strong and safe, and I've never been so grateful for his friendship, for his steady existence in my life.
"It's going to be okay,"
he whispers.
"I swear."
"Liar," I sniff.
"Well, there's a 50% chance I'm right."
"Kenji."
"Hmm?"
"If I find out you're lying to me about any of this, I swear to God I will break all the bones in your body." A short laugh.
"Yeah, okay."
"I'm serious."
"Uh-huh."
He pats my head. "I will."
"I know, princess. I know."
Several more seconds of silence. And then, "Kenji," I say quietly.
"Hmm?"
"They're going to destroy Sector 45.
"Who is?"
"Everyone." Kenji leans back, raises an eyebrow.
"Everyone who?"
"All the other Supreme Commanders," I say. "Nazira told me everything." Unexpectedly, Kenji's face breaks into a tremendous smile.
"Oh, so Nazira is one of the good guys, huh? She's on our team, trying to help you out?"
"Oh my God, Kenji, please focus. I'm just saying,"
he says, holding up his hands.
"The girl is fine as hell, is all I'm saying."
I roll my eyes, try not to laugh as I wipe away errant tears.
"So,"
he nods his head at me,
"what's the deal? The details.
Who's coming?
When? How? Etc.?"
"I don't know," I say. "Nazira is still trying to figure it out. She thinks maybe in the next week or so. The kids are here to monitor me and send back information, but they're coming to the symposium specifically because apparently the commanders want to know how the other sector leaders will react to seeing me. Nazira says she thinks the information will help inform their next moves. I'm guessing we have maybe a matter of days." Kenji's eyes go wide, panicked.
"Oh, shit."
"Yeah, but when they decide to obliterate Sector 45, their plan is to also take me prisoner. The reestablishment wants to bring me back in, apparently. Whatever that means."
"Bring you back in?"
Kenji frowns.
"For what? More testing? Torture? What do they want to do with you?"
I shake my head. "I have no idea. I have no clue who these people are. My sister," I say, the words feeling strange as I say them, "is apparently still being tested and tortured somewhere, so I'm pretty sure they're not bringing me back for a family reunion, you know?"
"Wow."
Kenji rubs his forehead.
"That is some next-level drama."
"Yeah."
"So? What are we going to do?"
I hesitate. "I don't know, Kenji. They're coming to kill everyone in Sector 45. I don't think I have a choice."
"What do you mean?"
I look up. "I mean, I'm pretty sure I'll have to kill them first."
Warner. My heart is pounding frantically in my chest. My hands are clammy, unsteady. But I cannot make time to deal with my mind. Nazira's confessions might cost me my sanity. I can only pray she is mistaken. I can only hope that she will be proven desperately and woefully wrong. There's no time, no time at all to deal with any of this. I can no longer make room in my day for these flimsy, unreliable human emotions. I must live here now, in my own solitude. Today, I will be a soldier only, a perfect robot if need be, and stand tall eyes betraying no emotion as our supreme commander, Juliet Ferrars, takes the stage. We're all here today. A small battalion posted up behind her like her own personal guard. Myself, Delalu, Castle, Kenji, Ian, Aaliyah, Lily, Brendan, and Winston. Even Nazira and Hader, Lena, Stefan, Valentina, and Nicolas stand beside us, pretending to be supportive as she begins her speech. The only ones missing are Sonia, Sarah, Kent, and James, who stayed behind on base. Kent cares little about anything these days but keeping James out of danger, and I can't say I blame him. Sometimes I wish I could opt out of this life, too. I squeeze my eyes shut, steady myself. I just want this to be over. The location of the biannual symposium is fairly fluid and generally rotational. But in recognition of our new Supreme Commander, the event was relocated to Sector 45, an effort made possible entirely by Delalu. I can feel our collective group pulse with different kinds and levels of energy, but it's all so meshed together I can't tell fear and apathy apart. I'm focused instead on the audience and our leader, as their reactions are the most important. And of all the many events and symposiums I've attended over the years, I've never felt such an electric charge in the crowd as I do now. 554 of my fellow chief commanders and regents are in the audience, but so are their spouses, and even several members of their closest staff. It's unprecedented. Every invitation was accepted. No one wanted to miss the opportunity to meet the new 17-year-old leader of North America. No. They're fascinated. They're hungry. Wolves sitting in human skin, eager to tear into the flesh of the young girl they've already underestimated. If Juliet's powers didn't offer her body a level of functional invincibility, I'd be deeply concerned about her standing alone and unguarded in front of all her enemies. The civilians of this sector may be rooting for her, but the rest of the continent has no interest in the disruption she's brought to the land, or to the threat she poses to their ranks in the re-establishment. These men and women standing before her today are paid to be loyal to another party. They have no sympathy for her cause, for her fight for the common people. I have no idea how long they'll let her speak before they rip into her. But I don't have to wait long. Juliet has only just started speaking. She's only just begun talking about the many failures of the re-establishment and the need for a new beginning, when the crowd becomes suddenly restless. They stand up, raise their fists, and my mind disconnects as they shout at her, the events unfolding before my eyes as if in slow motion. She doesn't react. 1, 2, 16 people are on their feet now, and she keeps talking. Half the room roars upward, angry words hurled in her direction, and now I can feel her growing angrier, her frustration peaking. But somehow, she holds her ground. The more they protest, the more she projects her voice. She's speaking so loudly now, she's practically shouting. I look quickly between her and the crowd, my mind working desperately to decide what to do. Kenji catches my eye, and the two of us understand each other without speaking. We have to intervene. Juliet is now denouncing the re-establishment's plans to obliterate languages and literature. She's outlining her hopes to transition the civilians out of the compounds, and she's just begun addressing our issues with the climate, when a shot is fired into the room. There's a moment of perfect silence, and then Juliet peels the dented bullet off her forehead, tosses it to the ground. The gentle tinkling sound of metal on marble reverberates around the room. Mass chaos. Hundreds and hundreds of people are suddenly on their feet, all of them shouting at her, threatening her, pointing guns at her, and I can feel it. I can feel it spiraling out of control. More shots ring out, and in the seconds it takes us to form a plan, we're already too late. Brendan falls to the ground with a sudden, horrifying gasp. Winston screams, catches his body. And that's it. Juliet goes suddenly still, and my mind slows down. I can feel it before it happens. I can feel the change, the static in the air. Heat ripples around her, tongues of power unfurling from her body like lightning preparing for a strike, and there's no time to do anything but hold my breath when suddenly she screams. Long, loud, violent. The world seems to blur for just a second. For just a moment, everything seizes, freezes in place. Contorted bodies, angry, distorted faces, all frozen in time. Floorboards peel upward and fissure apart, cracks like thunderclaps as they shatter up the walls, light fixtures swing precariously before smashing to the floor. And then, everyone. Every single person in her line of sight. 554 people and all their guests. Their faces, their bodies, the seats they sit in. Sliced open like fresh fish. Their flesh feathers outward, swelling slowly, as a steady gush of blood gathers in pools around their feet. They all drop dead.
Juliet, I started screaming today. An excerpt from Juliet's journals in the asylum. Were you happy? Were you sad? Were you scared? Were you mad the first time you screamed? Were you fighting for your life, your decency, your dignity, your humanity? When someone touches you now, do you scream? When someone smiles at you now, do you smile back? Did he tell you not to scream? Did he hit you when you cried? Did he have one nose, two eyes, two lips, two cheeks, two ears, two eyebrows? Was he one human who looked just like you? Color your personality. Shapes and sizes are variety. Your heart is an anomaly. Your actions are the only traces you leave behind. An excerpt from Juliet's journals in the asylum. Sometimes I think the shadows are moving. Sometimes I think someone might be watching. Sometimes this idea scares me, and sometimes the idea makes me so absurdly happy I can't stop crying. And then sometimes I think I have no idea when I started losing my mind in here. Nothing seems real anymore, and I can't tell if I'm screaming out loud or only in my head. There's no one here to hear me, to tell me I'm not dead. An excerpt from Juliet's journals in the asylum. I don't know when it started. I don't know why it started. I don't know anything about anything except for the screaming. My mother screaming when she realized she could no longer touch me. My father screaming when he realized what I'd done to my mother. My parents screaming when they'd lock me in my room and tell me I should be grateful for their food, for their humane treatment of this thing that could not possibly be their child, for the yardstick they used to measure the distance I needed to keep away. I ruined their lives, is what they said to me. I stole their happiness, destroyed my mother's hope for ever having children again. Couldn't I see what I'd done, is what they'd ask me. Couldn't I see that I'd ruined everything? I tried so hard to fix what I'd ruined. I tried every single day to be what they wanted. I tried all the time to be better, but I never really knew how. I only know now that the scientists are wrong. The world is flat. I know because I was tossed right off the edge, and I've been trying to hold on for 17 years. I've been trying to climb back up for 17 years, but it's nearly impossible to beat gravity when no one is willing to give you a hand. When no one wants to risk touching you. An excerpt from Juliet's journals in the asylum. Am I insane yet? Has it happened yet? How will I ever know? An excerpt from Juliet's journals in the asylum. There's a moment of pure, perfect silence before everything explodes. At first, I don't even realize what I've done. I don't understand what just happened. I didn't mean to kill these people. And then suddenly, it hits me. The crushing realization that I've just slaughtered a room of 600 people. It seems impossible. It seems fake. There were no bullets, no excess force, no violence, just one long, angry cry. "Stop it!" I screamed. I squeezed my eyes shut and screamed it, anger and heartache and exhaustion and crushing devastation filling my lungs. It was the weight of recent weeks, the pain of all these years, the embarrassment of false hopes manufactured in my heart, the betrayal, the loss. Adam, Warner, Castle. My parents, real and imagined. A sister I might never know. The lies that make up my life, the threats against the innocent people of Sector 45, the certain death that awaits me, the frustration of having so much power and feeling so utterly, completely powerless. Please, I screamed, please stop. And now? Now this. My limbs have gone numb from disbelief. My ears feel full of wind, my mind disconnected from my body. I couldn't have killed this many people, I think. I couldn't have just killed all these people. That is impossible, I think. It's not possible. Not possible that I open my mouth and then this. Kenji is trying to say something to me. Something that sounds like, "We have to get out of here. Hurry, we have to go now." But I'm numb. I'm dim. I'm unable to move one foot in front of the other, and someone is dragging me, forcing me to move, and I hear explosions, and suddenly, my mind sharpens. I gasp and spin around, searching for Kenji, but he's gone. His shirt is soaked in blood, and he's being dragged off in the distance, his eyes half closed, and Warner is on his knees, his hands cuffed behind his back. Castle is unconscious on the floor, blood running freely from his chest. Winston is still screaming even as someone drags him away. Brendan is dead. Lily, Ian, Aaliyah, dead. And I'm trying to reconnect my mind, trying to work my way through the shock, seizing my body, and my head is spinning, and I see Nazira out of the corner of my eye with her head in her hands, and someone touches me, and I jump. I jerk back. "What's happening?" I say to no one. "What's going on?" "You've done beautiful work here, darling. You've really made us proud. The reestablishment is so grateful for the sacrifices you've made." "Who are you?" I say, searching for the voice. And then I see them. A man and a woman kneeling in front of me, and it's only then that I realize I'm lying on the ground, paralyzed. My arms and legs are bound by pulsing electric wires. I try to fight against them, and I can't. My powers have been extinguished. I look up at these strangers, eyes wide and terrified. "Who are you?" I say again, still raging against my restraints. "What do you want from me?"
"I'm the Supreme Commander of Oceana," the woman says to me, smiling. "Your father and I have come to take you home."
Warner.
Juliet. "Why don't you just kill yourself?" someone at school asked me once. I think it was the kind of question intended to be cruel, but it was the first time I'd ever contemplated the possibility. I didn't know what to say. Maybe I was crazy to consider it, but I'd always hoped that if I were a good enough girl, if I did everything right, if I said the right things or said nothing at all,
I thought my parents would change their minds. I thought they would finally listen when I tried to talk. I thought they would give me a chance. I thought they might finally love me. I always had that stupid hope. An excerpt from Juliet's journals in the asylum. When I open my eyes, I see stars. Dozens of them. Little plastic stars stuck to the ceiling. They glow faintly in the dim light, and I sit up, head pounding as I try to orient myself. There's a window on my right. A sheer, gauzy curtain filters sunset oranges and blues into the room at odd angles. I'm sitting on a small bed. I look up, look around. Everything is pink. Pink blanket, pink pillows, pink rug on the floor. I get to my feet and spin around, confused, to find that there's another, identical bed in here, but its sheets are purple. The pillows are purple. The room is divided by an imaginary line, each half a mirror image of the other. Two desks, one pink, one purple. Two chairs, one pink, one purple. Two dressers, two mirrors, pink, purple. Painted flowers on the walls. A small table and chairs off to one side. A rack of fluffy costume dresses. A box of tiaras on the floor. A little chalkboard easel in the corner. A bin under the window, full to the brim with dolls and stuffed animals. This is a child's bedroom. I feel my heart racing. My skin goes hot and cold. I can still feel a loss inside of me, an inherent knowledge that my powers aren't working. And I realize only then that there are glowing, electric cuffs clamped around my wrists and ankles. I yank at them, use every bit of my strength to tear them open, and they don't budge. I'm growing more panicked by the moment. I run to the window, desperate for some sense of place, for some explanation of where I am, for proof that this isn't some kind of hallucination, and I'm disappointed. The view out the window only confuses me. I see a stunning vista. Endless rolling hills, mountains in the distance, a massive, glittering lake reflecting the colors of the sunset. It's beautiful. I step back, feeling suddenly more terrified. My eyes move instead to the pink desk and chair, scanning their surfaces for clues. There are only stacks of colorful notebooks, a porcelain cup of markers and glitter pens, several pages of fluorescent stickers. My hand shakes as I pull open the desk drawer. Inside are stacks of old letters and Polaroids. At first, I can only stare at them. My heartbeats echo in my head, throbbing so hard I can almost feel them in my throat. My breaths come in faster, the inhalation shallow. I feel my head spin and I blink once, twice, forcing myself to be steady, to be brave. Slowly, very slowly, I pick up the stack of letters. All I have to do is look at the mailing addresses to know that these letters predate the reestablishment. They've all been sent to the attention of Evie and Maximilian Summers, to a street in Glenarchy, New Zealand. New Zealand? And then I remember, with a sudden gasp, the faces of the man and woman who carried me out of the symposium. "I'm the Supreme Commander of Oceania," she said. "Your father and I have come to take you home." I close my eyes and stars explode in the blackness behind my eyelids, leaving me faint, breathless. I blink my eyes open. My fingers feel loose, clumsy as I open the letter at the top of the stack. The note is brief. It's dated 12 years ago. M and E. All is well. We've found her a suitable family. No sign of powers yet, but we'll keep a close eye on her. Still, I must advise you to put her out of your mind. She and Emmeline have had their memories expunged. They no longer ask about you. This will be my last update. P. Anderson. P. Anderson. Harris Anderson, Warner's father. I look around the bedroom with new eyes, feeling a terrible chill creep up my spine as the impossible pieces of this new insanity come together in my mind. Vomit threatens. I swallow it back. I'm staring now at the stack of Polaroids untouched inside the open desk drawer. I think I've lost feeling in parts of my face. Still, I force myself to pick up the stack. The first is a picture of two little girls in matching yellow dresses. They're both brown-haired and a little skinny, holding hands in a garden path. One of them looks at the camera, the other one looks at her feet. I flip the photo over. Ella's first day of school. The stack of photos falls out of my trembling hands, scattering as they go. My every instinct is shrieking at me, sounding alarm bells, begging me to run. Get out! I try to scream at myself. Get out of here! But my curiosity won't let me go. A few of the photos have landed face up on the desk, and I can't stop staring at them, my heart pounding in my ears. Carefully, I pick them up. Three little brown-haired girls stand next to bikes that are slightly too big for them. They're all looking at each other, laughing at something. I flip the photo over. Ella, Emmeline, and Nazira. No more training wheels. I gasp, the sound choking me as it leaves my chest. I feel my lungs squeeze and I reach out, catch the desk with one hand to steady myself. I feel like I'm floating, unhinged. Caught in a nightmare. I flip through the photos with a desperation now, my mind working faster than my hands as I fumble, trying and failing to make sense of what I'm seeing. The next photo is of a little girl holding the hand of an older man. Emmeline and Papa, it says on the back. Another photo, this one of both girls climbing a tree, the day Ella twisted her ankle. Another one, blurred faces, cupcakes and candles, Emmeline's fifth birthday. Another, this time a picture of a handsome couple, Paris and Layla, visiting for Christmas. And I freeze. Stunned. Feel the air leave my body. I'm holding only one photo now, and I have to force myself, beg myself to look at it, the square Polaroid shaking in my trembling hand. It's a picture of a little boy standing next to a little girl. She's sitting in a stairwell. He looks at her as she eats a piece of cake. I flip it over. Aaron and Ella is all it says. I trip backward, stumbling and collapse onto the floor. My whole body is seizing, shaking with terror, with confusion and impossibility. Suddenly, as if on cue, there's a knock at my door. A woman, the woman from before, an older version of the woman in the pictures, pops her head inside, smiles at me and says, "Ella, honey, don't you want to come outside? Your dinner is getting cold." And I'm certain I'm going to be sick. The room tilts around me. I see spots, feel myself sway, and then, all at once, the world goes black. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Restore Me by Tahira Mafi, performed by Kate Simses and James Foey. This program was produced by John Marshall Media, executive producer Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2018, by Tahira Mafi. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.